recording it, and I can hear you clearly, and hopefully you can hear me clearly too.
I can. I've misplaced my water, so I'm just going to quickly run and grab that.
Okay, that's cool.
Hello and welcome to List Envy. My name is Mark Stedman and this is the podcast in which I collaborate with a special guest to build a top five list on a topic that they choose. Now, this week's topic is products that have moved humanity forwards, and building that list with me is a product designer and a Dragon's Den pitcher. I was going to say contestant, but that's like, it's not a game show. But yes, he walked, well, yeah, I mean, it's not a spoiler. He walked away with the investment. But it's Simon Heap. And it was a really lovely chat with Simon. A little bit of minor telephony interruption at some point during the episode because he's a busy man. But Simon designs products for sport mainly now. He's also designed a CD player and a funky looking potato masher. Links to pretty much all of that you will find in the episode notes, also at listenvypod.com, which is where you can go if you want to get new episodes delivered automatically to your phone. That's the best place to go because it will tell you how to do so. We actually have videos showing you how to subscribe to a podcast if you've never done it before. That's how much we care. And by we, I mean me. I care about you. So there's that. You can also sign up for the newsletter and you'll get new episodes and links and things. Stuff that you don't get in the show notes, you don't get in the episode. You will only get that extra stuff by signing up to the newsletter. So you can do that also at listenvypod.com or by looking for the link in your phone. That probably does it. I mean, what more can I help you with? Oh, last week it's not much of a milestone, but last week was episode 10 of the podcast, which so way. But it feels weird because that's not very many episodes, right? But I've recorded loads, and I've still got quite a few yet to record, and so it feels like this is an old show, or if my autocorrect on my phone is to be believed, an old shoe. But, you know, it's quite a young buck. But there you go. I tell you what, I'm having a lot of fun doing it. And I hope you are enjoying listening if you've been listening before. And if you're new to the show, then scroll back. We're getting to the point now where we're going to start to have overlap in some of the episodes, which is really nice. So if you like this one, you might want to check out episode 1, which was with sleep and respiratory scientist Max Thomas, where we talked about scientific discoveries. There's a bit of a crossover in this episode. But that's quite enough preamble. Let us go to the amble. This is myself and Simon. By the way, I'm Mark Stedman. I don't know if I told you that. Hi. This is myself and Simon Heap. And our top five products that have moved humanity forwards. So why in particular did you want to pick this list?
Because, you know, I'm a product designer by trade. You know, that's what I've done my whole life, right from the point where I was aware that you could create stuff, you know, when I had Lego and realised that I could do make a better version of something, or at least, you know, play around with rockets and car suspension stuff. I just, you know, that's been my whole thing, is making a better mousetrap, I guess. And so, you know, it just seemed like a natural thing. You know, if you talk about top fives, the only two things that I would say I really want to talk about is music. And, you know, that's hugely subjective and based on, you know, loads of stuff which has nothing, you know, we can have an argument forever about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or a discussion forever.
Yes, indeed.
Or products where, you know, I am an active part of that constituency, and you know, I have views which are influenced by, you know, years of creating stuff for people, some of which is good, some of which I'm not, you know, so happy with. So, you know, it seems like an obvious thing to do.
Absolutely. And it's mainly in the field of sport that you're designing.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's one of those things. I've always loved playing sport and watching sport. And so, although you don't train to become a sports designer, you train to become a sort of generic designer of stuff. And, but I had a consultancy in London and we got a few customers or clients who came through with ideas for sports products that we helped them create. And it just struck me that, you know, I really enjoy this part of it a bit more than all the other parts. So I wondered whether there was a potential of creating a company that specialized in the design of products for sport, and there was. And so I wouldn't say I drifted into it. I made a conscious decision to be a, you know, to try and be somebody expert in the creation of products for sport. And, you know, remarkably, there was a market for it. So, you know, I haven't been doing that exclusively over the years, but certainly a lot. There's been a lot of sport design. I've done a lot of design for sport, which is incidentally the name of the company. So, you know, there's a good history of things that that I've done, which, yes, across a wide variety of activity.
Can you give us, I'm quite curious, can you give us an example of a product that you've designed?
For sport or anything?
Yeah. Well, for anything, really.
Okay, well, I mean...
It's a broad question, I know. Yeah, give me a thing you've made.
Anybody who's ever worked in the creation, you know, I mean, you could sort of describe me as a serial inventor, really, I suppose, because, you know, the real value in what I do and what people like me do is to create something novel, which other people haven't seen before, or it makes the boat go faster. Mm-hmm. You know, so I created stuff all the way from, the UK's best-selling potato masher.
Oh, now I am intrigued.
Oh, really? Okay. If you Google Spudnik, S-P-U-D-N-I-K, then yeah, that's one of mine. I think it's still sold. It's only sold, it used to be sold in the Science Museum, but we sold it all over. And it was mashing. You know, I like food, and I was mashing potatoes, and I thought, God, you know, she's annoyingly irritating, you know, somebody ought to come up with this. And, you know, so it sort of went out. So the idea was that instead of mashing up and down, you use the weight of your hand and your arm just to gently crush the potatoes, and then you can sort of rotate it around and squeeze them together. And, you know, it was a good alternative. It looked really funky.
I'm looking at the photos. It does.
Ah, good. And so, yeah, it did really well. You know, so it's I worked on Spun. You know, that was my creation. What else have I done? You know, with other people, we've done work for the. Well, I always call it the New London Taxi, but the old London Taxi when they changed from the you know, from the old shape to the new shape. We worked on that. Mm-hmm. I've done motorbikes. I've done. Done adult toys, which is a story in itself. All sorts of stuff. And then in the sort of sporting world, you know, I've worked extensively with Team GB, especially the run-up to the 2012 Olympics, and created some interesting stuff for them, which my 75-page non-disclosure document says I can't talk about.
Why don't you start me off with your top number one hit, what has absolutely got to be the best product that's moved humanity forwards?
It's so difficult, isn't it? Because,
yep.
because you know, there's the big ones, and then there's the small ones, which you know, they might have influenced you or been a, you know, you could have gone, I could have gone with, you know, with a mobile phone, with a smartphone, you know, communication. You could have gone with, you know, any electronic device, creation of the transistor, you know, something that made computers possible. But I think right at the top, I'm still not sure, as I'm talking to you, I'm still not sure whether I've listed them down but without putting numbers by them. So I'm sort of...
That's okay.
Okay, so I'm going to go with the wheel.
Ah, wow, okay. I mean, yeah, like that makes perfect sense.
I just think, you know, anything which has enabled humanity to move effectively from, you know, one place to another, to build, to create, to move themselves, to move building materials, food, you know, and you know, improve communication. So suddenly you aren't limited by the stuff you can carry on your back. or the stuff, two or three of you can carry. It's something that will, that can take the weight and make things easier, reduce friction, get you through as, you know, any, as far as you want, as fast as you can go. And then you can hook something else onto it, like a horse or a donkey or a, you know, an internal combustion engine or an electric motor. And suddenly you can travel thousands of miles. You know, I think ultimately that's got to be top of the list. And I don't even know why I doubted myself now. It's got to be number one.
I mean, it's hard to argue.
Go on then,
I'm not gonna. I started saying that in a tone that says, right, yeah. I am going to argue this. I think the reason I said that is I've gone so different with my list. I obviously did think like the wheel was like the first thing I thought, but for some reason, I thought, I don't know. I've possibly gone more, not exactly consumer products, but things that might be purchased. So like rather than the transistor, I was thinking about the machine that it enables. So that's kind of how I base my list. But I mean, you don't get anything without having the wheel. So it's kind of a no-brainer.
I think it's a good reason for it. But you know, and to be honest with you, that is the trouble with if you say that, you know, top five lists of products that have improved humanity, it's a pretty wide list. That you're going, it could be anything. So no names, no Patrick, it's fine.
Indeed. All right. Well, for my number one, I'm going for DeForest's RJ6, which is the first vacuum tube Audion receiver that was released in 1914.
Right.
So some of these I've gotten specific just to give us an example, but essentially I'm talking about the first wireless, sort of consumer available wireless radio.
Interesting. So mass communication, availability, spreading of information, propaganda.
Yep. That features quite heavily in okay. my list.
Can't think why. What are we doing again? Podcast.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me more.
I've got a few, as I said, I've got a few sort of communication devices, but for this, I wanted to pick the wireless radio that would be in the home, because at this point now, the development of this kind of technology in the home paused because, you know, there was a war on and stuff. But we get the development of the BBC. And with that, we have an incredible history of broadcast, which takes us through, you know, but not just the communication, but how we choose to use those airwaves, for the sort of Reithian idea of education, entertainment, and information.
Yeah.
Especially during, you know, wartime, it was you know, a fascinating thing when you had shows like It's That Man Again, which were these sort of music hall shows making fun of, I think that was Second World War, making fun of you know, of Hitler and all that kind of stuff. But you also had crucial information, and without this fundamental concept of, just as you were talking about the wheel moving, physically moving things, the spread of information knocking down those barriers, I think is an incredible leap forward.
Interesting. I mean, I agree with you 100%. And in fact, one of my we might well agree on something on our list. So so that's interesting. Yeah, I know this dissemination of information. It's interesting that you've gone for an electronic or an electric device rather than, I don't know, I mean, you know, the telegraph or you know, carrying pigeon or something like that. You know, I suppose it's the first time that mass media has been able to communicate in a broadcast way rather than a narrowcast way.
Yes.
And what is interesting now is that we are going back to a narrowcast culture where, you know, instead of people like the BBC disseminating information and spreading knowledge, you're getting factions, small, you know, caches of people who believe what they want to believe and ignore everything else because it might not be what they believe in. So it's maybe we've come full circle. maybe we're into a different sort of environment.
Yeah, very, very possibly. Ooh, this is, all right, it's going to get interesting. What is your number two?
Okay, so number two is, it's the creation of fire. And I've specifically said the friction match, which was the first operational one, was 1826. I think from that point on, being able to create heat and light at will is a relatively modern phenomenon. I mean, you know, you can make a good argument to say, well, yes, but of course, you know, you can create fire through a lens if it's sunny enough, or you can create it through friction. You know, you can create it through chemical means, which is, you know, been done for thousands of years. But to make it easily available and safe-ish, I think that's a turning point in again, you know, being able to read at night democratizes the spreading of information. And in the same way that radio and wireless broadcast enabled people to, you know, sit around the wireless set and listen to the sort of, you know, the BBC talking about the latest movements on stock markets or you know, agriculture or developments in technology or whatever. You're able to give people the ability to consume information in a way which is longer. You know, if they're in the fields all day working, and they come home and, you know, maybe they've had a fire going, but if they've got to get the fire going and then you know, it's a difficult thing to read. Whereas if you've got matches, you can, you know, light as many candles or wicks or whatever as you want at will, relatively cheaply. Then you're able to learn more.
Wow. I had never considered portable fire as in that kind of way. As something that enables us to spend more time gathering knowledge. I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I tell you what is interesting is that I think when it comes down to it, a lot of these, you know, humanity depends on communication. Mm. And so probably necessarily a lot of your list and my list might have a lot of communication devices on them or enablers of communication. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's you know, one way of thinking about it, you know, a portable fire bringing device.
Absolutely. Okay. So my second is, I'm very well aware that we're going to be coming at very opposite directions. I think we're going to meet in the middle with our lists, but I think we're coming at them in very opposite directions. So, my number two is the first commercial airliner, which started flying in 1914, which I believe, again, the same. I didn't just Google 1914, but it seems like that's what I've done. It went at a top speed of 64 miles an hour and just did a short hop in Orlando, in Florida. It was the Model 14 Benoist airboat, but it's the first commercial airline.
Okay.
Or airliner.
I love it. So this was, commercial. So that would be, so clearly 1914. So when was the first, when was Kitty Hawk? When were the Wright brothers?
Oh, now, 19th century.
Okay. I just wondered how long it took before somebody figured out, hey, we can take, you know, passengers on this, because, you know, they did do, I know the Wright brothers used to go around, you know, county fairs, and they came to the UK and demonstrated their, you know, Kitty Hawk flyer, and they took paying passengers on there, but only it wasn't a scheduled route. It wasn't from, you know,
absolutely
A to B.
Yeah,
which I think is the definition of a commercial, you know, an airline route is exactly that.
According to Dr. Google, I wasn't masses off, so I don't feel like too much of an idiot, but it was December the 17th, 1903. That was the Kitty Hawk taking its first its first flight.
So that's actually, that's incredibly quick progress. I mean, you know, that's another thing about...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, look at the development of technology and people, you know, I always say that actually it's not the... it's not the creation of technology or invention that moves things forward. It's the recognition of what it can do for you. So, you know, somebody saw the Wright brothers create this thing and thought, God, this could be faster than it could fly us over fields and mountains, and we don't need to lay track, and there's no roads to sort out, and I don't need to worry about, you know, wheels. And so... That's, you know, it's fascinating, isn't it? Between 1903 and 1914, that short gap, somebody thought there's a commercial opportunity here and I'm going to run with it. And then, of course, there's the war, which massively increases technology and the pace of innovation. So, you know, I don't know what this plane looks like, but, I mean, I imagine it's going to be pretty, you know, sealing wax and tape. And then after the war, you've got enclosed cockpits and, you know, an amount of comfort. So, yeah, extraordinary. But again...
And then in-flight peanuts.
Naturally. But again, it's, you know, it's communication, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big... believer in the concept of standing on the shoulders of giants, and the, just as you were saying, that it's so often the technologies themselves are interesting, but it's someone going, ah, but what if also we did this? I mean this I'm sure maybe something that you know, but as someone with a technical background, I can release a feature on a product, and almost invariably the first thing that someone says is, could it do this? And it's like, well, I've just built a whole thing. But now the first thing that people think of is, all right, what could it do next? What's the next thing it can do? And that is a wonderful thing when we look at the products that we're looking at, is they are enablers for us to go, all right, well, yeah, fine. What next? What do we do?
An interesting point is that human beings are so good at working around problems that they very often don't see the problems in front of them to solve. And my experience is that people, you create something that solves a problem, and you say, people go, that's great. Ah, could it do this? And you know, it inevitably your sort of natural reaction is to go, well, yes, but.
yeah.
And
but it's mine. I made it.
So there's a, well, actually, that's one thing you have to get over as a commercial, you know, innovator. You have to sort of go, well, yes, you've got a point. Mm-hmm. You know, human beings, they're so good at working around things that it's quite difficult to see why things should be better. You know, the big steps, the big leaps in, you know, it's what Henry Ford said about the car, you know, is that if I'd asked anybody what they wanted, they'd have said a faster horse. And, you know, it's a very,
yes,
it's a very famous quote, probably misquoted, but it absolutely hits the nail on the head, because, you know, horses were fine. And who knew that there was something that would be better and revolutionary, because human beings do not think in that way naturally. They think about the stuff that's around them, what they know about, and how it could be slightly better. So it's incremental improvements. You know, you need somebody extraordinary, really, to make that step change. So, it's just a fascinating, you know, it's a fascinating thing.
What's number three?
Number three is it's not a communication thing. So I've moved away from it, but everything else is. But so I'm going for, by the way, I've got six things on my list, but well, you know.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm going to go penicillin.
Ah, fantastic.
Because, you know, up until the creation of penicillin, you would be killed by some quite trivial minor ailments. You know, bacteria causing illnesses and viruses will, you know, would give you raging temperatures, and, you know, your body would kill itself, let alone the viruses. Whereas the advent of, you know, penicillin 1928 changed everything. And, you know, going again, sort of looking at the doomsday scenario and going back to sort of the idea of you're narrowing the opportunities, narrow casting, antibiotics are now specifically targeted because the broad ones don't work anymore. So it's extraordinary how quickly, 1928 to 2019, you know, suddenly the savior of humanity comes out. What have we got on the horizon? Well, I'm not so sure, but, maybe mm-hmm. we're going to go back to a very narrow cast future where people die of preventable diseases because we've developed a resistance to the drugs that will save you. Yeah. There'll be zombies around the corner next.
That's an upcoming episode. Speaking of episodes, this came up and was my second pick on episode one of this very podcast, where we were talking about positive unintended consequences in science. Otherwise put as journeys to scientific discovery. So we were talking about things that were accidental, but otherwise were interesting discoveries in science, and that featured very heavily for me for obvious reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. But in my terms, it is still a product because it's something that was created, had to be formulated, put together with other things, and made into a sellable or giveawayable thing. Which, you know, from my definition of a product, that absolutely fits. I would suggest that, you know, whereas communication has spread knowledge and, you know, that penicillin has spread health and wellness throughout the world, where will it end?
Indeed. Well, yes. okay. I'm going back to communication and... I'm going for a specific product, but this is what we might consider an avatar for a larger subset of products. And it is the Nokia 8110.
Oh, great choice.
Otherwise known as the flip phone.
Yeah.
The famous flip phone from the late 90s, which has been re-released as a sort of Android-y type smartphone thing. But I'm not interested in the smartphone in this particular list at the moment. Not in my list anyway, because... this was desirable and very desirable. It featured very heavily in The Matrix, and so everybody, there was just this period, the late 90s, early 2000s, everybody wanted this specific phone. There were a few others that were very popular, the sort of candy bar, as they call them, the candy bar shaped phones that were popular around the time as well. But I'm interested in this because it really marked a turning point to where phones became, they crossed that Rubicon from very nerdy things that people had possibly in their cars, the old car phones, salesmen who thought they were very important and needed a car phone, to sort of, you know, real tech nerds who had a few. Then you got to people who actually saw this thing and thought, oh yeah, I want one of these, and it ushered in the era by which these products were really commoditized.
So you came from a functional product to a desirable, lustable product.
Absolutely. And it's that desirability that I think helps it spread. And for us to then justify what we do in sort of seven, 8 years later in starting to, cause you know, yes, you've got the Palm thing and the BlackBerry and stuff, and those were stepping stones that get us to the smartphones that we understand today. But I don't think you get there without having something that people really wanted in their hands.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I mean, I when you started saying Nokia phone, I thought you're going to be talking about the 8210, the mm-hmm. you know, the brick phone, not the brick phone, but you know, the yep. phone that is indestructible. I've still got two sitting mm-hmm. on the shelf over there, which probably I haven't used them for 10 years, but I expect if I switch one on, would probably work. But they were supremely functional, but not desirable. You had one because you needed to, or you wanted to have mobile communications, but you would never say there was something that looked cool or did stuff. Whereas I'm really surprised though that you didn't go first iPhone, because for me that was that's the only product I've ever owned that I've walked into a pub and brought it out and people have gone, whoa,
yeah,
I've got to get, let me show me that, show me that, show me what it does. And, you know, I've had tens of people gathered around going, that's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, genuinely, you know, wanting one, which I think is extraordinary. Really, you know, that, so I hear what you're saying, and I you know, certainly, you know, films like The Matrix, well, actually, I mean, that was a particular one, wasn't it? Because their communication was that,
yeah,
was that phone. But you know, things like that, that sort of communication device, which it's ironic, isn't it? The phone rings while we're talking about phones. Anyway. Well, why didn't you go for the iPhone?
Possibly there's the contrarian in me, but possibly there's a slight element of hipster that didn't want to go too obvious. But I think I genuinely think I wanted to get to the thing that got us to the thing.
Okay.
To slightly misquote Steve Jobs, and I have got an Apple thing that's next in my list. But I was really thinking about the object that got us to a point where we wanted smartphones. Or we could conceive of them being desirable. I came to the iPhone a little bit later, so I was the last in a bit of a cohort to have one. But I absolutely had that with the iPad. I saw that and I was transfixed, and I absolutely loved that device and still do. I don't know what it is, but there's something in the iPad that has always felt more special. And I get upset when I ding my iPad, whereas my iPhones that I've owned over the years have been in a shocking amount of disrepair because they feel much more functional.
That's interesting. That is interesting.
But I think it's something that I'm not going to have a fight about, because it's, you know, the iPhone is such a not just iconic but valuable and valued contribution. Well, we'll see where we go with the list. What's next on yours?
Okay, so I have got the World Wide Web.
Mm.
Tim Berners-Lee, working at CERN 1989, comes up with a specification for an interlinked use of the internet. Obviously, you know, there are two different things, the internet, World Wide Web. The internet was very well known and was used extensively, you know, in the military and academia to spread information. But it didn't have the way of linking articles and cross-referencing them across a web of networks. And, you know, his crucial thing was appropriating the hypertext links and creating a specification where, you know, one computer over here can talk to one computer over there, and also creating a browser in the way that we understand it to be able to read information and to consume it. You know, in terms of a product which has revolutionized again the you know, for good and for bad, for sure, the way that human knowledge is being disseminated, I think it's a very, its effect has been extraordinary in such a short amount of time. Extraordinary.
Absolutely. My number six was the Mosaic web browser.
Ah.
Because I was thinking again, sort of in terms of products, because obviously, given what I do, the web was very high on there, and I kind of thought I wanted to think in terms of a real, what we might consider a product, and so I'm certainly not going to fight you on this one. I thought it was interesting. I went for the thing that gave people the ability to browse the web. But yeah, I absolutely, like, it's. It remains a phenomenal thing, and I think the way that it was constructed was, it could have been a lot more restrictive than it was, and it was built the way parsers and web browsers were built. They were built to be forgiving. They were built because I think they were built by people who understand academia, and they understand that people are going to learn, and they shouldn't be punished for whether they misplace a bracket or something, because we all know what they're trying to say, and we should render the page appropriately. And, you know, that now gets us to a point where you have some websites that work in some browsers and some that don't in others. But that's a different matter. The thought behind it was so pure.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a game changing. You know, I'd be very hard to argue that any product in the last, well, I don't know how long, maybe all of humanity has done more to perhaps, you know, to spread information, but also perhaps to harm. You know, to create this narrow casting environment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. And obviously, but you know, even in this chat, you know, we've both of us referenced Google and, you know, looked at images and stuff like that. Before that time, you'd have to go to your bookcase and flick through the Encyclopedia Britannica, and you know, if you had it, and try and reference it. It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. All human knowledge is there, good and bad.
Yeah. The speed of access, the fact that we can settle an argument or find a fact and then move on from that very quickly. We can learn something so quickly, and then fueled by that knowledge, we can get on to the next thing. Again, it's that idea of getting to the next thing. Wonderful. Right. Well, my next one is the Apple Macintosh.
Hey.
Mm-hmm. So it kind of comes again to desirability and to making something that felt not approachable necessarily, but making something that felt like a quote unquote product, you know, that rather than a computer terminal, this actually felt like something that a human could use, and ushered in a new era of computing that made it accessible, that made it something that many, many people could then have access to. It has its dark side in that it ushers in a period where we now have everything is glued. You know, all the different underpinning parts of computers are, you know, glued and soldered together, and they're very hard to repair. And mm-hmm. we have proprietary parts and everything, which goes against what Wozniak wanted, which is to build a kit. But the trade-off with that is that you get to have something in your hand that you can understand and work with very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'm 50. So I cross over the sort of the computer technology era, I suppose. The interesting thing is that, you know, there's some friends of mine, you know, still describe themselves as the sort of steam-powered, you know, people in a digital world.
Oh, like a Luddite.
Yeah, kind of. And it's almost like a badge of honour, and you know, which is interesting. And I can side with that. I can understand that as a point of view, because, you know, having crossed that era where, you know, I did computer studies, computer science at school with a mainframe computer that was... I can't remember how much storage we had, but it was in a separate room, and it was a massive hard disk that you would wait for hours for it, literally hours for it to turn on in the morning if you had to, if it wasn't running overnight and they had to do a hard startup, it was just, you know, it was a long time to get it going. But I was naturally drawn to it because I thought, well, this is exciting and fun. And so I was an early adopter at a ZX80, a ZX81 from Sinclair, then, Texas Instruments TI-99/4A, which had full 16 colors and 16, I'm going to say K, that doesn't sound right, but I think it was, of RAM. And I bought a one of the early Macs. In fact, I'm looking at it now on the shelf. I've got a Mac Classic still on the shelf, which I got in 1989, I think, 1988. Mm. So I love Macs. I'm talking to you through a Mac. I'm absolutely not an Apple apologist, but by goodness, they really changed the way that uses of computers, it became less about the nuts and bolts of it, and it became more about the output. And as a, you know, as a designer, as a an engineer, you wanted to, you use tools, and computers became a usable tool rather than one that you had to fettle all the time and tune and kind of mess around with. So I'm completely with you. I'm slightly surprised you didn't go iMac rather than Mac, simply because, you know, for me that was the one that really changed everything. I think, you know, the Mac was certainly the you know, the one that introduced the idea of a user interface, user experience being the thing that made the difference. Mm-hmm. But the iMac became so ubiquitous and became a lustful item, exactly as you were talking about with the Nokia phone, that, you know, this was a thing that you really wanted. And it was funky. It came in colors, you know, amazing, fantastic adverts. People really wanted them.
That's absolutely true. And I think it was the beginning of the transformation of Apple. When Steve Jobs came back and started working with Johnny Ive, I think that is really interesting because, in terms of moving humanity forwards, I feel like the original Macintosh did more, but in terms of creating an impact in a different way, the iMac really did, and it moved Apple forward in a huge leap, because it then enabled them to make the iPod and to go from there. But remarkable
yeah,
machines.
Absolutely.
I never had an original Apple. I was, you know, we were DOS people, Microsoft DOS and IBM type machines growing up, but I think there might have been an Acorn somewhere, but never Apple. I came to it very late. What's your number five?
Number five. Okay, so again, I'm looking at this thinking, well, I've got five and six, and I've got to choose one. I'm going to go for the marine chronometer. You know, John Harrison, the whole longitude thing, be able to accurately predict where you are on the ocean. Again, it just changed everything because you knew suddenly where you were. You know where you were traveling to. You could accurately plot your position on map. Maps became accurate. Your trade increased. You know, knowledge of other cultures changed and improved. We became a smaller world, a whole world. So, you know, and the story, people knew that we had to create this instrument to be able to accurately plot our progress across the sea. And, you know, the story of its creation is incredible. You know, that a wood was a carpenter, wasn't he? John Harrison created this chronometer that was, you know, hugely technically advanced, ahead of all the other, you know, scientists and technologists who were working at the time, and then refined it to the point where not only did it work on the land, but it would work on the sea on a pitching boat. It's, you know, extraordinary, and was rewarded for it. So, you know, it's a great story, and you know, I think it's the right one to sort of, you know, complete your list of five on it by saying it changed humanity's course. I mean, arguably it would have happened anyway and at some stage, but you know, still awesome.
Wow. I love that. That had never occurred to me at all. But that's, you know, that's why I'm not a product designer. That is, yeah, I've got nothing to add. But in terms of an enabling device, yeah, absolutely. Another thing that makes the world smaller, and I think better for it. So, oh, that's wonderful. Right. Okay. Mine's going to seem very odd now in comparison. But my number five is the audio cassette.
Oh, old school. Yep.
Yeah. 1964 originally, but you know, if you grew up in the 80s, they were
the thing.
They were everywhere. Yeah. And I mean, People are trying to tell me that they're coming back, and I can't believe it. I want mini discs to come back first.
Fantastic! I love mini discs.
I bloody love mini discs. Oh, they're so wonderful. Yeah. In fact, if there's anyone I should talk to about this, I've had this long-standing thing with friends that there should be a German word, because it's always got to be German. There should be a German word for the particular pleasure that you get in a kind of mechanical interaction. The way that you put a mini disc into the player, or the way it springs and you know, springs in and out, that there's a pleasure in that, and a satisfaction in that kind of tactile experience. And it feels like it should be a word like, you know, verschnurkenschlinkt or something that,
I think,
you know, sums up that,
I
that pleasure.
I think there is I don't think it's a German word. I think it's a Japanese word.
Sure.
I think it's a phrase, and it's to do with the tea ceremony. I you know, when you experience, I don't know if you've done, you know, been through a sort of tea ceremony thing where.
No.
It's extraordinary. If you're interested in that kind of user experience and the basis of how people, how humanity enjoy that sort of deferred gratification, you can see all the elements are there. You know, you take you wash the dishes, you steep the tea, you pour the tea, you wait for it to be the thing, you offer the tea forward. It's extraordinary. By the time you get to taste the tea, it's the best thing you've ever had.
Mm.
Because it's about the journey from starting from leaves and a bunch of utensils to the point where it's presented to you beautifully at the right temperature, with the right level of brewing. You're gagging for it. And I think that's it. When I was designing turntables, it was one of those things that I was, in fact, it wasn't turntables, it was CD players. When CD players came in,
mm-hmm.
and I was adamant that we had to inject an element of risk, of jeopardy into the process, because that, I thought, was part of the enjoyment of putting a record on a turntable, was dropping the needle,
mm.
and that clip, that whether you got it right or wrong, or you missed the track you wanted, or, you know, there's a ceremony in it, and there's a ceremony in putting a disc into a mini disc player, and there's a ceremony in ejecting a cassette tape and putting your pencil in, and, you know, getting the tape taut. You know, it's the stuff that humans like doing. And and it is built into us. You know, it's hardwired in us to enjoy that sort of thing. And as a product designer, I'm very well aware that's something that, you know, if you can put that into a product, the opportunity for that product to succeed is raised significantly. Which is, again, counterintuitive, because actually what you imagine would be is you get to the end point as quickly as possible. Hence, you go from turntables, cassettes, mini discs, iPods, streaming. But where's the joy in that? I don't want everything immediately. You know, I don't want to. I do, but then I don't. You know, I don't want to be able to click my button and listen to anything in the world instantly. You know, sometimes it's useful for a thing, thinking, oh, what's that latest? You know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, if I'm listening for pleasure, I want to be able to. There has to be an element of jeopardy. There has to be an involvement. You know, you can get it wrong, and that's important. The fact that you can get it wrong is important.
Yeah, I love that. Yes, it's the cassette. Also, it has it marks its last use. It's not like, you know, even with a mini disc, or with actually even with vinyl, really, a cassette knows where it was the last time you were listening to it, so it kind of carries the story of
quite poignant
what you were doing. What you were doing the last time. Oh yeah, right, okay, because I'm pressing play on this album, and the last time I was listening to it, I had to stop halfway through because my mum called me down for tea or whatever it is, because it doesn't automatically rewind.
Mm.
You've got that, and you know, there were lots of lovely innovations around the cassette. I mean, the time I saw the first, it was a Sony Stacker hi-fi system that had a play button and then what looked like a reverse play button,
oh, yeah.
Which would flip the tape round and then play the other side.
Yeah, yeah.
which played havoc then with you looking at the tape, because it physically did something to the tape, which meant that the side that was printed A was no longer the A side.
Well, I also it's the start of the disruption of the idea of an album or a mixtape which plays things in particular orders. You know, the mixtape, absolutely, you know, the most romantic thing you could ever do for anyone is to do them a mixtape. Or, you know, the best thing you could ever do for a friend is to, you know, is to communicate you're giving a bit of your soul,
absolutely,
with a mixtape. And, you know, that's gone now, because you can play the things in any order. Just hit shuffle and away you go. Because actually, I don't like your mix. I like my mix.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if I could woo a lady with a Spotify playlist. I'm not sure.
No chance.
No chance.
Sorry. But, you know, that's not a comment on you. That's just, you know,
No.
That's technology. You can't do it. You know, it doesn't mean as much.
No, indeed. Well, we have got ourselves some lists here, and I'm really interested to see where we go. I think a lot of this, I want to take from your list, because I think we are there's one where we have a very definite crossover, in the web. But otherwise, I'm really interested in what we've got. So you've got The Wheel, The Friction Match, Penicillin, The World Wide Web, and The Marine Chronometer. Have I convinced you that anything from my list makes a top five apart from the web?
I mean, I'd add it to the list, but I wouldn't necessarily knock any of mine off.
Right. Okay.
The radio, I think, has a strong case. Yeah, I think because it democratized communication. But you see, my number six was the printing press.
Yeah.
And you know, which is doing a similar sort of thing at a different time, and arguably the World Wide Web just took that to the nth degree. So maybe somewhere in there, we could agree that there was a enabler of mass communication, which could be a combination of the radio, the printing press, and the World Wide Web. You're not going to buy that, are you?
No. Sorry, no. I just feel this feels too broad. I mean, I don't know that I absolutely have to fight for anything that I've got on my list, because I've got one on there, so I can be happy with that.
Okay.
And I think, I think what we're doing is charting humanity's progress. It's interesting that we sort of go from Penicillin, the Marine Chronometer, to the World Wide Web. We've made quite a jump, but that's the nature of the way it works. I've got to fight for the radio here, Simon, because I feel without it, we're not charting humanity's progress in quite the same way.
Okay, which one do we take out then?
I wonder if we take out the Marine Chronometer, because I understand completely this idea of being able to navigate the world. I don't know. I'm finding it difficult. We can't have a top six. We've got to have a top five, which means something's got to go. I don't want to get rid of penicillin, because, you know, we'd die otherwise. I don't know that I can, Simon. This is hard.
Sorry. I was going. Do you know what? I was going to say The Wheel. That would be my. It's not. It's the trouble is, it's really hard to talk yourself out of that. It's just, you know.
Yes. Okay. What I will argue is by not being on the list, we're not putting it into room 101. Mm. You know, we're not denying its existence and saying that the other things can't exist without it. We're simply saying, you know, is it a product in the same way that everything else is? And that's an area with which I think we could have a discussion.
Yeah.
So how would you feel about, in no particular order, the match, penicillin, the web, the chronometer, and the radio? Do you think that's doable?
I'll go with it. I'll go with it.
Okay. All right.
But, you know, without the wheel, you wouldn't be able to, you know...
Yeah, but we, you know, we haven't talked about electricity, and without electricity, we wouldn't have two of these items. So I think
okay, I'm going to say
it's not exhaustive.
I'm going to make your case for you and say the wheel is a mechanism,
okay,
and not a product.
Yeah.
So all right, yeah. I will. I'll go with that on a technicality.
Okay. the technicality being the definition of the that's fine. Right, this is lovely. Okay, so now that we have our actual five, we just need to put them in the right order. And I feel like it goes friction match, penicillin, chronometer, radio, web. Do you think so? I'm going to ask you formally, Simon Heap, do you consent to this list?
I do.
Way. Oh, I was worried for a second.
Yeah, that doesn't mean I won't change my mind, but at the moment,
no, absolutely.
As of this moment in time, it makes sense to me, and I'll go with it.
Well, you can change your mind, and you as and anyone else is completely free to disagree. But this is a definitive list, and it has now been decided.
Okay, good, excellent.
Did you have anything else? So you had a number six.
Well, there was a printing press. Yeah.
Yeah, which is I mean, it's wonderful. I had a number, basically what was my number seven, which is, it's a product that doesn't actually exist, which is why it didn't make my top five. But the concept of it, I think, is something that's moved humanity forwards. And it's the Star Trek communicator.
Huh. Okay. But it does exist pretty much, doesn't it, these days?
It does now. In lots of different ways. I mean, it's not quite the little sort of badge that you can put on your lapel, but the idea of, I think in some of these cases, I think this has actually been a written thing as well, that in certain circumstances, the product, the aspirational product that sci-fi authors write about, then it spurs people to think, actually, could that be something that we could do? What could be the science behind that? And then we end up creating things. And so that's the only reason I wanted to give it a quick honourable mention.
Fair enough. Well, in that case, I'm going to go with a tricorder, because that is...
Yeah.
There is a prize. There's a prize on offer for the person who can produce a demonstrable tricorder that can do everything that Bones is one could do. You know, you can just scan over a person. It will tell you whether they're... what's wrong with them. So...
yeah,
you know, I'll buy that. Why not? No, I don't have any others on my list. I mean, there's you could go on forever, and so I stopped at five or six.
That's absolutely. I think we've done a sensible thing there. This has been wonderful, and thank you, Simon, for helping me. For mostly building this list. Where can people, what should people do to find more about you and your work and the products that you make?
Well, you can hit me up on LinkedIn, Simon Heap, and find me on Facebook or Instagram or any of the other sort of social, Twitter, social media stuff. I was in the, if you Google Dragon's Den, I've been on Dragon's Den. So you can find me on there and see what I look like and see how stupid I sounded. But we still get investments, so ha-ha.
Boom.
And, find me anywhere you want. Simon Heap. There aren't that many heaps. So I'd be happy to engage with anyone.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time today. This has been an absolute pleasure, Simon. And I still don't have a formal sign off, so I will leave any goodbyes to you. I will give you the last word.
This is a Steve Wright moment, isn't it? Where you go, thanks for everyone listening, mm-hmm. and everyone else that knows me.
There you go. That's lovely.